I'm joined once again by my friend, writer Sam McCarthy, who is a news and commentary writer over at The Washington Stand. If you want to check out his commentary and news articles, you can find that in the link in the show notes below. Sam, thanks again for joining me. How are you?
Kyle, it's great to see you again. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great as well. So recently you wrote a commentary piece called Equality and the, I always want to say miserific, but it's not Ebenezer Scrooge. It is Equality and the Miserific Vision of Leftism. So I want to start with this question. How does the left's idea of equality differ from the idea of equality that we find in Christianity?
The Christian notion of equality is really predicated on God, you know, on each and every one of us being, first of all, made in the image and likeness of God, and therefore being an imago Dei, being made in the imago Dei, and Christ's sacrifice on the cross. You know, Christ died for each and every one of us equally. He died for you and me just as much as he died for Hitler, just as much as he died for, you know, drug dealers, anybody. He died just as much for each of us. So there is equality in dignity. That equality does not really extend beyond dignity. There are key and essential distinctions and differences. So as an example, male and female. There are key and even fundamental differences and distinctions between male and female. The interesting part of it is that those distinctions help preserve and even promote or cultivate that essential dignity, that inherent dignity. The dignity of the feminine is protected and preserved by that which is distinctly female, that which is distinctly feminine, just as the dignity of the male is protected, preserved, cultivated, and allowed to flourish by that which is distinctly male or distinctly masculine. The leftist idea, which finds its origins in hell, the leftist idea of equality, it kind of inverts the process. You know, I've written before quoting Archbishop Fulton Sheen, who described Satan as the ape of the church, who wants to establish his own anti-church. And so with every single good, with every single virtue that we have, you know, that the church explicates and clarifies, that Christianity cherishes and has carried through the ages, Satan takes each one of these and tries to invert it, tries to kind of turn it inside out, in a sense, cut it open, flip it inside out and wear it like a suit, you know. And he does that with this notion of equality as well. Instead of maintaining and preserving that essential inherent human dignity, which is the only way in which we really are equal, you know, in Christian truth, that's really the only way that we are all equal is through that human dignity, you know. He takes that dignity and the distinctions that protect and preserve it and tries to destroy those. And in destroying those, destroys the dignity. So all really do become equal, but equal not in dignity, not equal not in worth, in their capacity for true communion with God, you know, through the sacrifice of Christ, but instead become equal in misery, in what C.S. Lewis called the miserific vision.
Yeah, I love that phrase, the miserific vision. I mean, it's such a good contrast to what Christians call the beatific vision, which is that blessedness that we experience by being as close to our Lord as we can be in our existence after this earthly existence, God willing, if we make it there. Equality itself, so we have established that the left's notion of equality is very distorted, just like how Satan tries to ape what's going on in the church. Equality itself, you mentioned, it does sound like a pleasant concept, and indeed it is, if used properly, I would say. So I would ask, you know, should we be advocating for equality in some areas? Because the left always does this. They take a word that's a good word, they redefine it, and then they try to misapply it. But I mean, there are some things obviously where we are striving for equality. You mentioned we do recognize equality in terms of human dignity, in terms of our fallen human nature. We're all kind of equal in that. But there are so many various distinctions and differences between the different instantiations of that human nature, and those are each of us individual human beings. But there are some areas, right, where we're sort of striving for equality, right? You know, I think of simple things. It's like portions of food that I'm, you know, giving my children or whatever. But even, you know, based on the largeness of the children, the growth of the children, you're going to give different portions. But let's say, you know, second grade in school and they're giving out school lunches, they're trying to give an equal portion to everyone. So, you know, we're not totally against equality, but we're defining it correctly, right?
Yeah. And I think even more than that, putting it in its proper place. You know, the Russell Kirk said that the soul's first need is order. You know, God has ordained, he has set up an order. He has structured the world and the soul in a particular manner, you know, and that is when it is ordered. That is when things are in harmony with heaven. And outside of that, it becomes disorder. It becomes chaos, you know? And so I think that equality really is relegated to, I shouldn't say relegated because that is sort of a pejorative connotation, but it is sort of confined to a particular area. It is proper to a particular area, which is our dignity. That's the only place where really that equality is absolute. As you say, you know, like if you're dishing out portions of food for your kids, you know, chances are if you have a 15-year-old son, you know, who helps you with chopping wood and he's, you know, mowing the lawn every single day, you know, I don't know why he'd be mowing the lawn every day, but
get out there and mow that lawn every damn day.
He's doing work, you know, every day. And you have, let's say, a 5-year-old, you are going to give them slightly different portions because those different portions, in some sense, are going to be equal to them. It's going to be in proper measure, you know. It goes much more to the idea of justice, you know, and giving to each what each is due, as opposed to this sort of warping of justice that the left's notion of equality really brings to life, really manifests, you know, which is not giving to each his due, but perhaps taking from one his due to give to another who is due less just because that person has what we would call less, you know, comparatively or empirically speaking. And so the entire thing really is it should be proper to one particular area. And again, to quote from C.S. Lewis, he once said that there is a particular type of bad person who cannot do anything good or give up anything bad without also demanding that everybody else do the exact same. And so that it's kind of that principle, but applied to the soul, you could say, or applied to everything around the soul. You know, this idea of, you know, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, it's not just charity. It's not just I'm going to give of what I have, you know, for love of somebody who has less. Instead, it's I'm going to demand that everybody else do that as well, whether you recognize it as good, whether it's with your will or against your will or not. You know, it's this sort of attempt to mandate a already misunderstood notion of charity, you know, and charity cannot be mandated. Love cannot be mandated. You know, it cannot be forced or programmed. It can't be compelled. Otherwise, it ceases to become love.
Yeah. And when we have the left trying to governmentally implement this charity, or top down governmentally implement what they think is equality, it results in what you write as an absolute and abject misery. And as I read in your article, this recently played out in Canada. So can you explain what was going on there?
So, this is a little funny because there was this Pakistani restaurant, you know, they do Pakistani cuisine. They have this Middle Eastern restaurant in Quebec, And they start giving out meal vouchers. They put them up on the wall, and the idea is, you know, somebody comes in and they can pay basically for a free meal for somebody who's in need. And then the needy can, you know, accept those meal vouchers and redeem it for a free meal. It's this great kind of, you know, self-sustaining charity program. And it is, again, actual charity. People are choosing to do this. You know, it's out of their own volition. It's not because they're compelled to. And anyway, the government came in and shut the program down because the meal vouchers were only written in English.
Wow.
Yeah. So now you've got, because of this idea that, oh, well, there should be more languages on there. Oh, well, you have to be inclusive, you know? Because of that, you've now got all these poor starving people who knew where to go for food, who can't get their food anymore. Like, and you're denying other people, these people who come in and pay for these free meals, you're denying them this opportunity to exercise charity.
It's kind of like I think of how, you know, growing up, I went to public school and we had the public school textbooks for various subjects. And every single cover for every single class's book was all the same. It was like you had to have a kid on there. You had to have the white kid, the black kid, and the Asian kid, and the kid in the wheelchair, and whatnot. And it was like the same cover for every book. And I'm thinking like they probably did that too. The publishers were probably fighting with the school districts or, you know, the government or whoever makes these decisions about, oh, well, you have to include these pictures on the cover for kids to feel included in this particular subject matter. It's like, well, how does that have to do with learning about Napoleon or whoever from history?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm sorry, Napoleon wasn't a black girl in a wheelchair.
And I don't expect black girls from, you know, in wheelchairs to relate to Napoleon so much. Maybe they can. I don't know. Maybe they have a Napoleonic concept. Okay, so moving on, we have, you know, this again, this misguided notion of equality. It is part and parcel of not just one, but as you say, all of the left's agendas that they're always trying to push, whether they be mass migration, illegal immigration, feminism, the whole transgender thing, homosexuality, all the Skittles issues, and then even abortion itself. So how does equality, or their notion of equality rather, undergird all of those leftist agendas?
Well, again, I think that the key idea, you know, is that they're all destructive. Each of them erases and destroys key and fundamental distinctions, and those distinctions in turn preserve human dignity. You know, Satan famously cannot create anything of his own. God alone can create ex nihilo. What Satan can and does do is take the created good and warp it, pervert it. Right. And then present it as though it's a good. And you can still recognize, because it was a good, you can still recognize the kind of kernel or germ of good in there, which gives you a natural impetus towards that thing. But he's warped it so that it's no longer the fullness of that good, and it can actually lead to, and it often does, evil. And so that's really exactly what he's doing here. He's taking this idea of equality, you know, this idea, which we do see in heaven, you know, in the idea of the human dignity and each of us being equal in as much as in heaven, being united with God, you know, in full communion for all eternity with God. You know, he does take that idea, which sounds pleasant, largely because of that connotation, that good that it finds its origins in, and warps it and tries to hand that twisted, mangled little imitation of it back to us and say, try this instead, you know? So each of these things is like that. Each of these things is follows in that notion of that destruction. You know, transgenderism is probably the easiest one to just kind of pick apart really quickly, because it's that an erasing of that a fundamental distinction between male and female. You know, feminism kind of did the same thing ages ago, which, you know, I've written before, that's also led to transgenderism and continues to fuel the transgender crisis, especially amongst, you know, men who seek out trying to become women, because they're told by feminism, men are evil, men are toxic. Why would you want to be a guy? You know? So feminism kind of did that in a social and an economic, even to some extent a political sphere. Transgenderism just takes it to its kind of terminal, its final conclusion, and it performs that same operation, but in a more literal sense, in a surgical theater, you know, erasing and destroying those fundamental, those key and fundamental distinctions, saying that there really is no difference between male and female. You know, you're a boy, you know, you feel like you're a girl, fine. All that we got to do is just, you know, snip here, snip there, and, you know, stitch this and you're good to go. Great, now you're a girl. There's no real distinctions between the two. And you can see that playing out in the debate over the language of it too. I think of, you know, Biden's Supreme Court pick, Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, who was asked, you know, can you define what a woman is during the Senate confirmation hearings? And she said, I'm not a biologist. Like, that's not a matter of biology. That's a matter of just what is a woman. That's a matter of a woman being distinct from a man, but nobody will say it. Nobody will say a woman is distinct from a man. There are key, fundamental, insurmountable distinctions and differences. And so, of course, especially now with this surge in what we're calling the detransitioners, you know, that you see, and these horror stories that you hear from people who've gone through this experience or begun this experience and, you know, praise God, turned away, you know, before reaching its completion. You hear these horrific stories, and the single theme through each and every single one of these, the deepest theme is regret, profound regret, you know? So we know that this really is not equality, creating some kind of, you know, utopia. You know, it's not we are making heaven here on earth. It's rather in an attempt to make heaven here on earth, in a hubristic and misguided attempt to make heaven here on earth, we've made hell here on earth.
Yeah, and speaking of heaven, I want to just throw out a few concepts from your article and let you kind of break those open. You know, you mentioned Dante's vision or conception of heaven as different people as different or various sized containers, right? You have the people who are, you know, little shot glasses, and yeah, you know, he doesn't use that phrase. You have the people who are larger containers, smaller containers, various size containers. And the whole idea there is that each in heaven, God willing, if you make it to heaven, you are completely full. Your container is completely full with God's grace to the extent that your container will allow. So everyone's experience of heaven is full and complete relative to their sort of capacity for grace. And I love it. It maintains these differences and distinctions even in heaven, when we're all sharing that one beatific vision. So there's sort of a unity and diversity happening at the same time. And that's one. And then you also mentioned, I believe it's from The Great Divorce, Lewis's sort of tour of heaven and his unexpected model of holiness in the ordinary woman, who he mistakes for the Blessed Virgin Mary. And, you know, so we have those notions of heaven, and then contrast that with hell, where you have the equality that the left is sort of looking for. You have that equality that plays out in everyone's own misery. They're sharing in the same amount of misery. So your thoughts on those?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love, and I will say also, you know, I mean, I was just for researching this article and just for trying to find the right passages, just kind of glancing through Dante's Paradiso. You know, I mean, I've read it, you know, several times. I haven't read it in a while, but just even just grabbing a couple little lines from it, you know, it's enough to bring tears to your eyes. You know, the beauty of this poem and this praising of heaven, you know, this hope that we have for heaven is just, it's so powerful. And it's just, I think Dante really puts it very nicely. Lewis echoes that in The Great Divorce with this idea of, you know, in Lewis's imagination, the people in hell are, he calls them ghosts. They're kind of these smoky, you know, transparent, they seem very weak, you know, kind of figures. Whereas the people who are in heaven, he initially mistakes them for angels because they're solid, they're bright, and everything in heaven is bright. The grass itself, he describes it as like walking on diamond, for those who are not already in heaven, which I think also encapsulates that idea of, our sufferings and our trials that we go through here on earth kind of strengthen us for heaven, which is real. That's really what it is. Boethius talks about this idea as well in the Consolation of Philosophy, that good is reality. Sin, in the end, evil is nothing. It is not a separate thing. It is not some opponent to good. It is simply a diminishing or an absence of good, And I think really that's also what this kind of equality notion gets into, because in these distinctions that we have, these differences are real. Our dignity, our human dignity, kind of guarded by these distinctions and differences, is real. It's solid. It's tangible. It's something that we can sink our teeth into for all of eternity, and suck the marrow from the bone, as opposed to this equality that's proffered by leftism and proffered for centuries by hell in various modes. This hellish notion of equality, this diabolical equality, is nothing. In Lewis's vision of hell, as in heaven, where everything is real, everything is solid, and you have to become solid to, pick an apple from a tree, to eat it, to enjoy it, to run through the grass, to ride a horse. In hell, everything is the opposite. You can create whatever you want. He talks about people like Napoleon, who he imagines is in hell, and other, famous figures throughout history, famous kind of villains, so to speak, or even just regular ordinary people, they can make whatever they want. Their houses are enormous. He talks about Napoleon as having this massive, sprawling mansion, but it's not real. It's this kind of specter in his mind. And then, of course, he's dissatisfied with it because somebody else makes something bigger. So you have to go further away and make something even bigger, But none of it is real. And you see this with this leftism thing. It starts with, back in, you look 10 years ago, back in 2015, before Obergefell, this idea of the LGBT, I don't even know if there was properly a T at the time. Certainly not. It wasn't as vitriolic or understood to be as vitriolic as it is today. But the whole like kind of gay rights, gay marriage, quote unquote, kind of thing, it was this idea of, oh, well, all that we want is equality. Oh, well, all that we want is, if you guys can get married, before a judge, shouldn't we be able to get married like before a judge and everything? Shouldn't we be able to go to a church and ask, can we please get married? And it sounded so nice. This little, oh, equality. All that we want is equality. We just want to be treated fairly the same way you guys are. And it sounded so nice, and so many people went for it. And a lot of other people warned this is a slippery slope because this is destroying those fundamental distinctions and differences that preserve dignity, that preserve order. And now, as we've seen, we have none of that. We have that one fella, Jack Phillips. He's in court for like the third time in as many years for just saying, hey, I'm a Christian. I don't really want to make a cake celebrating a gay wedding. This makes national, international headlines. They know he's not going to make them the cake. And they go to him again because it's not really about, oh, well, we just want, oh, well, we'd like you to respect our views, so we're going to respect yours. It's no, we're going to force you to respect our views, regardless of what yours are, It's that hellish idea of equality. It's making everything equal, not by imbuing it with equal dignity, not by preserving that dignity through necessary and fundamental distinctions, but destroying everything. Everything is equal, but it's equal because everything has been burned to the ground.
Yeah, it's not just tolerance that the left is pushing for. It's always a you need to get on board and actively participate in our own disordered agenda. I mean, it is one thing to tolerate evil and sin, and to some degree that is allowable because, I mean, you look at just how God himself operates. He tolerates and allows some sin, but from God's perspective, it's a little different because he can always use those things to bring about a greater good. Thomas Aquinas even and Augustine even talk about toleration, even governmental toleration of certain sins for the common good. We're not saying they're good things, we just tolerate them to a certain degree. But for the left, it is not about that. It is everyone needs to get on board with the disorder stuff that we're pushing, or you're going to be juridically prosecuted, you're going to be raked over the coals in the public forum. So it's really an insidious thing that they've done here and are continuing to do to good faithful Christians and conservatives. I want to talk about this sort of idea of a reciprocal relationship, this back and forth between man's differences and distinctions and man's dignity. Right. So you have, obviously, if you look at humanity, all these different variations, these instantiations of humanity. Those are the each individual people. But then you have also this one concept of human dignity. But there's sort of, the one feeds into the other, right? It's sort of, if we were all the same, it would look one way, and that would be its own distortion or extreme. But if you had everyone totally different, that would be its own other distortion and extreme. But there is a middle way, between the two, where the distinctions and differences sort of contribute to the dignity and vice versa.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a common and guiding thread, which is that, we are all human. We are all made in the image and likeness of God. We do all have that inherent dignity. And we all have, for the most part, very similar needs in some sense. I mean, not just a biological sense. I mean, obviously, each of us needs, food, water, sleep, shelter, things of that sort. But you also have for the most part, the same spiritual needs. I think it was Herodotus, the Greek historian, who said that you may find a city without walls, you may find a city without families, you may find a city without a name. It says you can find all kinds of strange aberrations, but one thing you will never ever find is a city or a nation that does not practice worship, that does not sacrifice. Because we all have that inherent need in our soul for God, and whether that's something that, like the pre-Christian pagans, would have sought to satisfy without knowing God, without the gift of divine revelation, but we all have those needs. We do have that common, that uniting thread, that kind of it keeps us all together and gives us enough common ground, because of course the key thing being made in the image and likeness of God, God is three persons, one God, three persons. God is perpetual community in that sense, And so we do have an inherent need for in his image for that community, for that relating one to the other. That's why marriage is such a powerful and fundamental sacrament. It is our mirroring of the love of God, in physical human form, in imperfect form, certainly, but in physical human form, So we do have those common threads, those things that unite us, but those distinctions and differences help us to preserve that inherent dignity. I think a good way of looking at this, a good way of explaining this or illustrating it, is you look at individual nations, right? Let's just take England, for example, right? My wife and I visited Oxford and London last year, late last year, and it was a great experience. And there is very clearly, and it's much easier to find, I will say, with the mass immigration, it is much easier to find in Oxford than it is in London. But there is a distinct English culture, with certain, customs, certain even just the way that they cook. That's one of the things that people who support mass immigration often cite is, oh, well, all the different types of cuisine. But those are themselves distinct, and they are distinct to particular regions, to particular nations, to particular cultures and peoples, you know? You can't just erase those distinctions and just say, well, it's really all the same, because some of them are going to be completely and totally destroyed, you know? When you have, let's say, a bunch of people from the Middle East coming into England, they're frankly not going to really want fish and chips and, you know, steak and kidney pie and a nice pint of ale or lager, you know? They're going to continue going after the food that they want. And at some point, the rest of that culture, you know, is going to die away. It's going to die out. So that's one way you can look at it, that these distinctions preserve, because there is such richness, not just historically, but even in some sense, kind of spiritually, or in the sense of a pathos, you know, there is such richness in England, the nation. Same thing with other, you know, France, you know, the United States, even, you know, there is such richness in these individuals, you know, in their unique customs and that which makes them distinct. And those distinctions are really what help foster that dignity, you know, in humans. It's dignity. In nations, it can be a sort of a dignity based on the dignity of the humans, but the dignity that we find in ourselves, you know, you look at, say, even J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, you know, very similar men, but they were distinct, and those distinctions helped shape them, helped make the dignity of each of them, you know? And without those distinctions, what would be the point? If everybody were all just the same, and it is our common traits, that kind of uniting thread that also allows us to recognize the dignity in others and to appreciate the distinctions and differences. Unless we focus too much in a loathsome and loathing manner on our own distinctions and differences that we don't appreciate, that we don't like, the things about ourselves that we don't like, then we turn to hating the distinctions and differences in everyone, because we see it as it makes them better than I am. That makes him better than I am. That makes her cooler than I am. That makes him so much, you know, more admirable than I am. And just a desire to tear it down. It'd be like looking at two buildings, a short one and a tall one, and saying we should make them equal to each other, and instead of building up the small one, just tearing them both down. That's that leftist idea of equality and what it achieves.
Yeah, and it's always undergirded by this notion of jealousy, really, at the end of the day. And this discussion also reminds me of the biblical concept of, I think St. Paul talks about it, how God gives different talents and charisms and abilities to different people, but all of those are to be used in the service of God. That's one of the beautiful things that we see in heaven, is that yes, everyone's enjoying the same beatific vision to various degrees, but also they're still working, they're still active in heaven, and they're using their different charisms and things like that, which is why the church assigns different saints to be patrons of different things, because that saint had a special charism or a special interest when he was alive on earth. That is about all the time that we have for this installment of my interview with Sam McCarthy, again, writer over at the Washington Stand. His author page is linked in the show notes below. Sam, thank you so much for joining me again, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Great talking to you, Kyle. Thanks for having me.